From Illinois to Vermont, Mississippi to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Congress is broken and it can't fix itself. So is it time for a convention of states to provide a constitutional fix? Mark Meckler from Convention of States is here with details. Whoever wins control of Congress next month likely will do so with a very slim majority. How will that affect the legislature's ability to govern? Andy Roth of the Club for Growth is here with the real story. The national debt has hit another new high. Should we be concerned? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute. And Democrats are approaching the midterm elections with very different strategies in urban and rural districts. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Constitution of the United States can be changed by amendment or via a convention of states. Since Congress will probably not reform itself, the convention route is more likely to yield results. Mark Meckler is president and founder of Convention of the States and Convention of States Action. He is here to explain how a convention would work and why it is needed. Mark, welcome to American Radio Journal. Mark, when we talk about a convention of states, it's probably a process that most Americans are not familiar with. So tell us, what is a convention of states?
Yeah, you're right. It's something we've never done before in our history. It's found in Article 5 of the United States Constitution. It was literally put there 2 days before the end of the convention in 1787. And it's put there, this idea of the states getting together in convention, put there for the very purpose of pushing back against federal overreach. And what it is a process whereby two-thirds of the states, now 34 states, can get together, call a convention, get together in convention, and discuss ideas for restraining federal overreach. And specifically, the application we're pursuing right now, which has already been passed in 12 states, calls for fiscal restraints on the federal government, term limits on the federal government. That would include Congress, the courts, and the bureaucracy. And ultimately, I think the most important, scope and jurisdiction restraints.
Are you finding that the current system, the way that it is structured, Mark, particularly with Congress, with the lack of term limits and no real limits on power, are we finding that this isn't working as well as it did in the early days of the Republic?
Yeah, the real reason this is needed is, and you referred to structure, we've broken the structure of government in the United States of America. So the structure was set up correctly. I think it worked beautifully for the first 100 years, and then we started to break that structure. So we now need structural reforms, and the only way to get structural reforms is by calling a convention and imposing those structural reforms. One great example is term limits simply used to be imposed by people. People rotated in office. They didn't serve for 30, 35 years in the Congress or in the Senate. And so we didn't need term limits. Now we do need term limits. When the founders created the Supreme Court, for example, the Supreme Court, the justices' average age of appointment was 47, average life expectancy was 54. They didn't expect jurists to serve 30 years on the United States Supreme Court. So we've broken the system in some pretty fundamental ways that need to be repaired structurally. Those things aren't going to be repaired by elections.
What about the process by which we have amended the Constitution numerous times throughout the century, starting with the Bill of Rights, where you go amendment by amendment? Is that just too laborious of a process to try to get this type of systemic change that you're talking about?
Well, I don't think it's that it's so much more laborious. The issue is what we're looking at is controlling the federal government. If you look at the process, the other process for proposing amendments have to be proposed by Congress. What we're talking about is Congress needs its wings clipped. Congress needs balanced budget imposed on it. Congress needs term limits imposed on it. They will never propose those sorts of amendments. It would take two-thirds of both houses to propose it. Try to imagine a time when two-thirds of both houses of Congress propose a balanced budget amendment and term limits. That's just not going to happen.
They haven't even been able to balance the budget in the last couple of decades, let alone propose it. So we need this convention of states in order to bring about this type of change that is necessary at this point in our history. Mark, one concern that is raised is we do have, as I mentioned earlier, that Bill of Rights. And there is a concern that a convention of states could go rogue and maybe erode some of the God-given rights that are protected by our Constitution. How would you protect against that?
Well, first of all, the convention is called according to resolutions passed by the states. All states have to pass the same resolutions. Those resolutions preclude any discussion, frankly, of anything in the Bill of Rights. So it literally cannot even be discussed. When you get in convention, all the delegations are controlled by the states that sent them. The states limit what they can and can't talk about. Today, we need to remember there are 33 states with both houses controlled by Republicans. Every delegate that comes is controlled by their legislature. So if they even started to try to get out of bounds, they could be stopped by their states. And ultimately, the founders provided the protection, which was it takes 3/4 of all states or 38 states to ratify anything. You can do the math. I've run the math on every single amendment ever been proposed to me. You can't find an amendment that would limit our liberties that could be ratified in even close to 38 states.
Let's talk a little bit more about process. You touched upon it earlier, and the number of states that is needed. Tell us how many we have. You've mentioned how many we need, and where do we stand in the process of getting to the critical mass that would allow this convention of states to occur?
Sure. So it takes 34 states, or 2/3 of the states, to call a convention. So far, 12 states have done that, so we're just over 1/3 of the way there, which is extraordinary. People said it was impossible to get that far. We've gotten that far already. And so it takes 34 to get into convention. In convention, it takes 26 states to pass a proposed amendment out of convention. Important to remember, when you're in a convention, the only thing a convention can do is propose amendments. So people get all scared about getting into convention. It's merely a place where people will ultimately make suggestions. And then it takes 38 states to ratify anything that comes out of convention. I think we're well on our way. I think the 1/3 mark is a pretty extraordinary landmark. We have passed in another 19 states in one house or the other. You have to get both houses in a concurrent session. So I think we're well on our way, and I think we should expect to see some pretty extraordinary progress in 2019.
Mark, if you go back in history, and I realize that unfortunately it's not being taught at least to the degree it should in many schools these days, but tell us a little bit about the founding of the Republic. Didn't the states create the federal government, not the other way around?
Yeah, look, I think that's the history that's really important. The power pyramid was the states created the federal government. The states essentially were to retain sovereignty. They were to have broad, unenumerated powers. The federal government had to have limited and enumerated powers. It's now been reversed because of the rulings of the Supreme Court. And really importantly, in regard to the Commerce Clause, the federal government can pretty much do anything it wants to do constitutionally, and this is a big problem. And so we need to reverse that power pyramid, take the power away from D.C., make it so D.C. isn't so important. I would add one more thing. There's so much conflict and strife in this country right now politically. I don't like it. I don't think anybody likes it. The way you reduce that strife is you quit making centralized decisions. You take the power away from the federal government, give it back to the people in the states, let them make the decisions at home. We won't see these huge national fights anymore.
We have been talking with Mark Meckler, who is the president and founder of Convention of States and Convention of States Action. So, Mark, tell us just a little bit about Convention of States, your organization. Where can folks also go on the web if they want to learn more and get involved in the fight?
Sure. The project was founded just about 5 years ago, and it was founded to take power away from D.C., give it back to the people. People can read about it, get involved at conventionofstates.com. It's supported by literally virtually every major conservative figure in the United States that's commented on it, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, Senator Tom Coburn, Senator Jim DeMint, lots of senators, Sass and Rubio. They understand that Washington, D.C. isn't working, and the way to fix it is take the power away from D.C. and give it back to the people. If folks want to be involved in that, they can do that at conventionofstates.com.
Mark Meckler from Convention of States. Mark, thank you for being here.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on all these congressional races we have going on around the country, as well as U.S. Senate races. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Andy, as we've talked about many times, Republicans currently control both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. The Senate seems to be headed more in the Republican direction, but let's talk today about the House. Right now, can you give us an overview as to how many seats Democrats would have to gain and where do they stand in achieving that goal?
The Republicans are in charge of the House. It appears that they are going to lose seats. President Trump claims that there will be a red wave that will counteract that. And to be honest with you, we are kind of seeing something of a red wave, but the Dem wave was so big leading into the Kavanaugh hearings for the Supreme Court that if a red wave does crop up, it'll only reduce the Dem wave, just to confuse the analogy. So right now, Republicans are in the majority. Democrats have to pick up 23 seats. I think that right now you can count about 14 seats that will likely go Dem. So that means the Democrats only have to pick up 9 more. And when you look at the population of seats from which those 9 could come from, you're looking at about 29 or 30 seats. So basically 9 out of 29 or 9 out of 30, you're looking at about a third. So to me, it seems likely, barring everything else or all else being equal, that the Democrats are going to pick up the majority, but they will have a very slender, slim majority, perhaps single digits.
If we look at that, Andy, and whether it be Democrats by single digits or Republicans by single digits, what does that do for how the House becomes organized and its ability to actually function when you are that closely divided?
Truth is, we don't know, or at least I haven't experienced this in my working career when this has happened. When an election occurs, the majority in the House is either decisively Democrat or decisively Republican. If we got that close to just a single-digit majority, then we're kind of in uncharted territory, at least for the past couple of decades. Knowing House procedure and how the rules are structured, I suspect what would happen, and this would be fascinating just from a political science perspective, is that the majority party, presumably the Democrats here, would have to make some deal with the Republicans to share some level of power. If Democrats get control of the House, a lot of the Democrats that will be coming in have made several promises to their electorate that they would work across the aisle, that they would be somewhat conservative, and that they wouldn't vote for Nancy Pelosi as Speaker. So I suspect the first thing that would happen after November is that Democrats would probably elect somebody other than Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, and that person could be a more moderating voice or it could be a more liberal voice. It's really hard to tell. Then, once they're done with that, then they're going to have to vote on a rules package, and they do this every 2 years, and this package of rules dictates how the House proceeds with this business. Like, there's committee ratios and then the Rules Committee and how that's processed. So I could see a scenario where the committee ratios are very slender. I could see a scenario where the rules will require returning to regular order, which I think both parties would absolutely love, or at least both electorates, both voters would love. You would see more debate. You would see more control by the committees rather than by leadership. You would see more amendments being offered. You would see more discussion and debate about those amendments. You would, you would actually see a functioning House where the outcome is not preordained. They would have to go through the work of legislating before they can figure out whether a bill is going to pass or not. Now, this is all speculation on my part. I could be completely wrong. But when you're dealing with a single-digit majority in the people's House, you can't rule with an iron fist anymore like we've seen in the past 20 years.
In terms of that single-digit majority, whichever way it happens to break, we're presuming it's going to break Democratic at this particular point. But either way, you have, Andy, seen within the Democrat Party a rise of the ultra-left-wing Democratic Socialist movement. We're obviously going to have a couple of members of the Democratic Conference who are going to be of that variety. On the Republican side, of course, we have the Freedom Caucus, the more conservative element of the Republican Party. Is this really going to be a situation where Congress is effectively broken into really more like four factions rather than two?
It's going to be, the question is how strong is the appetite going to be for these various factions to grind things to a halt? And for the past 20 years, these factions have been adamant about advancing their agenda because they promised it. And leadership ends up screwing all of them because they don't want the government to shut down, or they have to bow to their K Street masters. They have to do all these things. Again, this is all speculation on my part, but I can envision, and maybe this is naive on my part, I can envision a scenario where these factions tamper down their desires as long as it means that they can voice their opinion and that they are given floor time and space to offer up their ideas, have them deliberated in the public, and then adjudicated. I don't know what that world looks like because we've been in such a dysfunctional state of mind for the past 20, 30 years. That is kind of hard to imagine, but perhaps, just perhaps, that is what happens. I'd be interested to hear other possible scenarios, but that one seems like the most likely one.
It is very interesting and will continue to be so. And then we add President Trump on top of all of this, which,
right.
which really sort of makes the whole pot stirred a little bit more. In any event, we're going to have a lot to talk about as we head into the election and in the years ahead with Andy Roth from the Club for Growth. Andy, a bit about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all 50 states in the union. We're united because we believe in economic liberty. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Another big jump in the national debt has caused warning bells to go off. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at the causes and effects of this problem with Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute.
Well, the federal government spends more money than it takes in. That's not exactly news to anyone who's been paying attention to politics for, you know, the last 20 years or so. What is news is what the Treasury Department reported this week. On Monday, the Treasury Department saying that the fiscal year 2018 budget deficit, that's the deficit for the fiscal year that ended on September 30th, was $779 billion. That is the largest federal budget deficit in a single year since 2012. That's right, since the first term of the Obama administration. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Brian Riedel. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he's also a longtime Republican congressional aide. He worked with Senator Rob Portman of Ohio for years, and he also crafted the deficit reduction plan for the 2012 Romney campaign. So Brian has been thinking about and writing about and talking about budgets and budget deficits for a long time, and we appreciate him stopping by the show. Brian, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So the budget deficit for the year that ended on September 30th, Brian, $779 billion. That's the largest since 2012. Break these numbers down for us. What's driving that big deficit increase that we saw over the last 12 months?
The interesting thing about the deficit is that it's rising during a time of economic prosperity, which you typically don't see. In the last couple of years, it's gone from $439 billion all the way to $779 billion. The rise of the deficit in the past year is due mostly to the tax cuts, which cost about $164 billion, if you include the interest, and that big spending cap deal where they raise the spending caps for defense and non-defense discretionary spending. That was about $146 billion. So without those two policies, the deficit would have been closer to about $450 billion. They push it up to 779.
As you said, Brian, we don't usually see big jumps in the deficit during times of relative peace and of prosperity. We are on course right now for a deficit that will exceed $1 trillion by the end of the current fiscal year, the 2019 fiscal year. So this problem is not going away. In fact, it's only getting bigger. Compare what's happening right now to the federal budget to where we were, say, in 2010 through 2012, those years where we had that deficit up around $1 trillion, even just over $1 trillion. How is it different now versus then?
We've had the deficit hit $1.4 trillion in 2009, which brought a lot of deficit hysteria around the country and a lot of concerns that brought the Tea Party. The difference is those $1.4 trillion deficits were a temporary result of a very deep recession. And when the recession went away, the deficit went down mostly by itself. Congress did a little bit of tax hikes, a little bit of spending cuts, the stimulus spending ended. and it dropped by itself. The difference now is that moving forward, the deficit is primarily going to be the result of Social Security and Medicare, 74 million retiring baby boomers and rising health care costs. That's not temporary. That's not going away. As a matter of fact, in 10 years, under a current policy baseline that assumes current trends continue, we're looking at a deficit of about $2 trillion a year, or even $3 trillion if interest rates rise. And about 80% of that deficit will be from Social Security and Medicare.
So you have kind of a combination of factors working here. You've got those short-term factors, the tax cuts, the spending hikes. Then you've got the long-term factors, those entitlement costs that you talked about. We are talking with Brian Riedel. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he is the author of a paper that is just out this week. Brian, we should plug this. It is titled A Comprehensive Budget Plan to Avert a Debt Crisis. You can find that at the Manhattan Institute's website, manhattaninstitute.org. And Brian Riedel is the author of that piece that looks at not so much the deficit that we're facing today, but really the quite scary numbers that we're going to be facing in 5 or 10 years if policymakers in D.C. don't get serious about dealing with this. Brian, tell us a little bit about what that sort of fiscal tsunami that is coming for us in the next 10 years if we don't sit up and look at this $1 trillion deficit and do something about it today.
Yeah, the numbers are staggering over the long term. In fact, it's hard to put it into words because it almost sounds like monopoly money when you say this. The national debt right now is $20 trillion. Over the next 30 years, Social Security and Medicare face a shortfall of $100 trillion, including interest, over 30 years. The numbers are too big to even imagine. So what it really means is that in order to pay out all promised benefits for Social Security and Medicare, we would have to double all tax rates. Double corporate tax rates, double your family's tax rates, double the payroll tax. The amount you send to Washington would have to double just to pay for the programs we've already promised. We're not even taking into account the Bernie Sanders $40 trillion agenda. This is doubling taxes just to pay for the benefits that we've promised.
There are a lot of details in the paper here, Brian, and I would encourage our listeners to check out the longer version of this interview that we have running at Reason.com right now. But you can get all the details there. You can read the paper and find it there. But in about the minute or so we have left here, Brian, what is the basic formula here to avoid this coming debt crisis that America could be facing in the next decade or so?
We need a Congress to actually come together on a grand plan, mostly entitlement spending, but taxes have to be on the table too. The plan that I've wrote to avert a debt crisis would have the policies take effect in 2023. And so in order to accomplish that, we got to get people to the table, start negotiating this stuff, start enacting it, and get it implemented. Because the longer we wait, the cost of reform rises by trillions. So this problem isn't going away. It's time to address the entitlement programs and, yes, probably put taxes on the table, too.
It's a really, really big problem. It could mean, as Brian said, it could mean the doubling of all the taxes that you currently pay to the federal government just to pay the existing debt in the system. It's a big problem. We're not going to solve it unless we start talking about it. So at least we've got people like Brian Riedel out there who are talking about it. Brian, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Thank you.
And again, that is Brian Riedel. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, former Republican policy wonk on the Hill as well. So you can check out his paper on the coming debt crisis at manhattaninstitute.org. Check out our coverage of the budget deficit and of what needs to be done to address it. You can also find a longer interview with Brian at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Politics is trumping principle when it comes to how Democrat candidates for Congress are crafting their messaging this election year. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College discusses on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Political parties pander, period. All parties do it. But what I'm seeing from the Democrats in 2018 is rather shameless. The Democrats en masse are changing their political colors from district to district and man to man and woman to woman and even swapping genders in other ways in a terribly cynical and rather reprehensible manner. Consider, literal Democratic Socialists of America, DSA candidates are being recruited and run by the Democratic Party. These are tried and true socialists, and they're running and defeating traditional Democrats, like the Costas, Paul and Dom Costa, in my home area of Western Pennsylvania. I'm here referring to local DSA members Summer Lee and Sarah Inamorato, who are on their way to the State House as elected socialists, actually formally elected Democrats. The same is true in the national scale for the elected Democrats such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But look at how the Democrats change their skins as they head out of the urban areas into more conservative districts. Look at the challengers to two conservative Republican congressmen, two men of genuine conservative principles, Mike Kelly and Keith Rothfuss. Those two are being challenged by Ron DeNicola and Connor Lamb. Those races, plus the DSA races of Lee and Inamorato, show what political panderers these Democrats are in 2018. Check out Ron DeNicola's profile. He's just like Connor Lamb, who the Democrats nabbed to win the Tim Murphy seat in a Republican and overwhelmingly pro-Trump district. DeNicola was a Marine, a boxer, the son of Italian immigrants. He went on to Harvard, the GI Bill, Georgetown Law. As a lawyer, DeNicola is said to have represented the great Muhammad Ali for 30 years. Connor Lamb, a similar profile, a Marine, an Irish Catholic, Central Catholic High School, goes on to University of Pennsylvania Law. I watched DeNicola's ads on local cable TV. The first words across the screen are, "The Fighting Marine." And then you see him with union guys in hard hats. Gee, what's next, Democrats? Resurrecting the corpse of Jack Kennedy? And yet I imagine this guy DeNicola, who they're trying to run as a moderate or even a conservative or as a kind of guy's guy, is probably on fire for transgender bathrooms and partial birth abortion. It's like Rocky Marciano waving a rainbow flag. Go outside of Western PA and you see this trend all over the nation. Speaking of waving a rainbow flag, check out another DSA champion candidate, Carrie Evelyn Harris, who left-wingers are touting as potentially the first biracial LGBTQ person to win a seat in the U.S. Senate. The 38-year-old Harris challenged three-term Democratic Senator Tom Carper of Delaware. In her ads, however, Harris ran as an Air Force veteran who served her country in the Middle East after 9/11. Yet another is Mikey Sherrill, a female Naval Academy graduate who flew helicopters in the Middle East. She's running in New Jersey's District 11. Talk show host Andrew Wilkow, who lives in that Republican district, marvels at how one can watch ad after ad by Sherrill and never learn she's running as a Democrat. So the Democrats find guys like DeNicola and Lamb to try to win conservative districts like those of Kelly and Rothfuss. And then on a dime, they flip the switch and run socialists like Ocasio-Cortez and Summer Lee and Sarah Inamorato in their super liberal city districts. In between, they nab candidates like Carrie Evelyn Harris and Mikey Sherrill. I ask the Democratic Party, have you no principles? Actually, they do, while they have one overriding principle, or I should say purpose, to win and secure power. And then, above all, they hope to achieve the added purpose of impeaching Donald Trump. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WKTZ-FM in Lachlan Heights, Maryland, WMSG-AM in Oakland, Maryland, along with WJPG-FM in Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.